So I'll just ask you, we'll start
Okay,
from the beginning.
Kathy.
Is
All right.
when were you born?
I was born on July 25th, 1920.
And were you born in your house?
I was born in the house next to what used to be the house next to the courthouse. My mom and dad lived there when they were married, and I was born in that house. And later, we moved over here in about two more years, 1923, I believe, we moved into this house at 534 East Hopkins.
Right. Okay, and tell us more about your parents. I know we have this from your mom, but let's start with you. Here's Gaylord. Let me put this on. Now we're going to talk about your parents, all right? Now,
okay.
Tell us what you know about who came when, and just do the whole family history for us.
Well, on my dad's side, my grandfather, John Melton Connor, came to Aspen in 1886, and his brother Emery Connor had preceded him about 6 months previous. And so my grandfather immediately went into the mines. He worked in and leased at that time. The first couple of years you worked for the company, if it was Smuggler Durant Mining Company or one of the other mining companies like the Argentum Juniata or some of those ones like that. And later on they found that it was probably more profitable for them after silver or the silver crisis in 1893 to lease blocks of certain portions of the mines, and they let the miners then produce from there, and they would charge them for the air to run the jackhammers or liners or stopers or whatever they were running. They charge them for sharpening the steel for the machines, and they charge them for hauling the ore out that they had broken to the out to the tram house to be put in the railroad cars and everything, and then they would get a percent of whatever it was they shipped to the smelter in Leadville. So that was the way they started. So my grandfather worked in as a miner or right up in the front where they were breaking the ore, I think probably for 7, 8, 9 years, and then he became a leaser, and he leased blocks of land, he leased with Mona Frost's dad and her uncle, the Jenkinson brothers. They had a lease.
What was Mona's father's name?
I believe it was Frank.
Okay.
And God bless us, I wish I knew. Well, anyway, it was he leased with the Jenkinson brothers in the Bonnie Bell, which is up in Turtelot Park. And then he stayed in the mines until about 1905. And at that time, then they got him involved in politics because he had been a Republican all of those years. I don't know, at that time, I don't know whether they called him populist or, well, anyway, he was a Republican. So he went into the courthouse then, into the county clerk's office as, first of all, he was a deputy county clerk, and later on he was elected as county clerk and recorder, and stayed in that office for, I'm not sure how many terms, but then was defeated, and then he went back into the mines again, but about 1918, right at the time of the, just right about the time of World War I, he went into the courthouse again as a deputy sheriff and custodian of the jail and those things like that. So that's why my connection with the courthouse is because my grandfather and grandmother were in the courthouse when I was born, and they lived downstairs. In that time, the whole downstairs was the sheriff's quarters, and my grandmother cooked for the people in jail, and granddad was court bailiff, among other things, and that stayed, and he stayed, I think they lived down there almost 20 years, so that's why they associate the lower part of the courthouse with our family quite extensively. And then after that, then he still stayed on as bailiff, but he retired around 1938 or 39 or thereabouts, and because I used to help him when I was a youngster, maybe 15 or 16 years old, I used to help him. And those days, the custodian of the courthouse done everything from top to the bottom to make a damn bit of difference if it was shoveling snow, all the walks, or if it was whatever needed to be done, all the cleaning, and those various things like that. And since my grandmother was a good cook, why, they always got along good with the jail fare and everything like that. And on my mom's side, my grandfather, Patrick Harrington, he came to Aspen in 1888.
From where?
He came from Ireland, but my grandfather, Connor, came, it was a jump sort of a thing. It came from Hagerstown, Maryland to Henry County, Ohio, and to Mount Pleasant, Iowa. And then, of course, they got the news that, you know, of the silver strike in Colorado and in Aspen and Leadville. And so, since things weren't too good in Iowa, that's why he came west. And the same thing with my grandfather. His two brothers had come to Leadville back in like 1884 and 1885. And so they, when he was old enough to be able to start to be able to work, they decided it would be a good thing for him to come to Aspen. And I think he got to Aspen when he was about 18 or 19 years old. And he immediately went to work in the mines and worked in virtually all of them, from the smuggler to the free silver to the... he worked up at the Newman, where the Aspen Country Day School is. That was a good mine then. He worked in that mine. And he stayed in the mines for about 22 years, and then he went into the grocery business with a man by the name of Ed Groskert, Groskurth, and Groskurth used to live right across the street from us, so that was good. And then, since my granddad stayed in the mines longer than my other granddad, he had run what they call dry machines, like the jackhammers and the liners, and he had contracted silicosis. And so he was ill for probably 6 or 7 years before he died, and he died in 1942, I think, because I know I had rheumatic fever when he died, and I remember I remember that date real well. I think it was in 1942. So that's kind of the history. And he met my grandmother here in Aspen. She and her aunt ran the Clarendon Hotel, which is up where Wagner Park is, you know, that big bugger of a hotel up there. And so she worked in there with her.
And spell Clarendon.
C-L-A-R-E-N-D-O-N, Clarendon.
Clarendon,
yes.
And it burned down. Yeah. Finally, didn't it?
And I don't know the date, but I would suspect, oh God, well, I better not say, but I imagine it was right around the turn of the century,
yeah,
or two.
It's one of the history books I read.
Yeah. And so that's kind of the way the twist. And my grandmother and granddad were married here. They were married over in St. Mary's my grandmother and grandmother were, on mother's side, were married over in St. Mary's, and then later mom and dad were married over there too. So that's kind of the history of the early part of our family.
Where did your father's father come from?
Well, my granddad's family originally came over from Ireland, but they came a long time ago, because my granddad's great uncle fought in the Revolutionary War when General Washington had a lot of one Irish brigade, I think it was. So there was a Connor in that thing, and then later after they got into Maryland, that part of the country became so populated, so they went to Ohio, and my great grandfather was county assessor in Henry County, Ohio. I think it was in 1836 or 38, and he was assessor there for, I think, 12 years, and apparently that was a pretty popular place, and that was about the time they started getting this assessor sort of government, you know, where you valued property and you levied tax against it. So, and then my granddad, Connor, before he came here, he was county assessor in Henry County, Iowa, for I think 4 years.
Everybody's an assessor.
So they that was.
Do you think it's in your genes?
Must have been for me. Yes, but anyway, they never. They said it was hard work, because you know you had to. You rode horseback, you know, and you might go 80 miles and have to stay someplace and make out a whole hell of a bunch of papers and stuff like that. And so it was never easy, but my great-granddad, I guess he'd done a pretty good job to keep that thing all the time, because it was political, and they called them townships, you know. They weren't counties like we have in there. So that started the thing, the Connor and Harrington family. And as I said, I was born in a little house next to the courthouse that was torn down many, many years ago, next to where Hannibal Brown lived and next to where Elizabeth Callahan is now.
Now, Warren, do you know how to spell Hannibal Brown?
H-A-N-I-B-A-L. Hannibal, yeah, just like...
It's just one N.
Yeah. Well, Jesus... I better not say that swiftly, because, you know, I never have written, I don't know whether we could,
maybe they'll have something in the historical society.
I'm sure, yeah.
It possibly has two N's, but, isn't that terrible? Because I may have written to Hannibal once or twice in my life, or written his name, but most of the time it was always... hollering at one another, or joshing at one another, or going someplace with one another, or something like that.
Can you recall approximately when your grandfather was defeated the first time?
In here?
It
was around 1910, I would say, something like that. Maybe 12. But it was... the politics wasn't very honorable in those days,
because it's all fixed.
No, it was
stuffed the ballot box.
Well, it was very much partisan, for sure, and some of the partisans, you weren't too sure whether they were part of your party or not.
Right. Do you remember any stories that your grandpa told you about the jailhouse? Have you ever had any scoundrels?
Yeah, well, sure. He had some of the people that were incarcerated were murderers. I know that. There were a couple that I remember that they used to say. And I don't remember their names. I know that one from out on Capitol Creek had shot someone and was in the jail and... or I killed him, I guess. And then I remember another one that he told me about. But he always would say, well, they were the nicest people when they were in jail, because I guess that old jail was a heller. You know, there was no place to go. My God, you couldn't got out of there if you had a tractor. You couldn't have plowed through that old thing. So
was the jail in the...
It was right down in the...
Okay, yeah. Because originally it was up...
That's right. And then when the courthouse got built in 1891,
that's where they moved it over.
Or 1890, they moved the darn thing down. It was right down in the southeast corner of the basement where the
sure.
the ready room is yeah. down for all of the guys down there. Now, in hell, it was
did he have any rustlers or?
You know, he had everything. Bootleggers was the main thing,
oh.
and mean ones
mean
too.
How long did a bootlegger have to be in jail?
Well, usually they only kept him in.
Up?
No, they kept him in. Like some of the times I remember, they had one in. It was called, I think it was Tony the Weasel, and Tony was in. Tony, I think. I believe the judge gave him like 4 months, something like that. So
they were the bootlegging. Then wasn't it federal? They weren't.
Yeah, they had a revenue officer that testified against them. Yeah, and anyway, somewhere in my possession, I've got a good picture of my grandfather and the county sheriff and the revenue officer. In the county clerk and recorder, in the county treasurer, out in front of the courthouse, front steps of the courthouse, out on the sidewalk, and they had, oh hell, I don't know, there must have been 30 or 40 gallons of bootleg in glass jugs, you know.
And, just lined up out there?
Well, they were all in these boxes and everything like that, and Frank Bruin, the sheriff, he had a hammer. Like you're getting ready to break them because they had to, you know,
yeah,
destroy the
debt.
Because the revenue officer had to watch them and everything like that. So, and there were various tales about the thing that said that Frank or the sheriff had things rigged up so that the revenue officer would watch him pour the stuff down the sink and it'd go down into the lower floor and down
in the
thing
bottle.
And there'd be somebody catching it.
Well,
that's.
Is that true? You know?
I think they kept a little bit. I don't know. My granddad never told me that exactly happened that way, although he said that perhaps that it did. But I do know that some of the times when they may be going to destroy maybe 16, 18 gallons, they'd keep a couple of gallons back to and be putting them down so the revenue officer. And the revenue officer in that picture looked like hell. I mean, he was young, and I think he had a cigar. And he must have brought his little boy with him when they took this thing. And he wasn't from here. See, they'd bring different revenue officers in from Glenwood or Leadville so that, they wouldn't get known around. So then that they'd go and they'd go to the dance and say, can you tell me where I could get a pint? And they'd say, well, I'll get one from you. I'll go to Mrs. So-and-so or I'll go to old Tony the Weasel or something. And then he'd be watching where they'd go, you know, and... making these notes, and then after a time or two, he'd get the drift and he'd say, well, they've got a still up there, or they've got a still over there, or whatever. And then they'd pull the thing, and then they'd have a different revenue officer the next time, and nobody would know quite what they looked like. But this, well, he had on bib overalls, if I'm not mistaken.
And a cigar?
Well, I think he had a cigar, but anyway.
That's funny.
That's a photo we might want to look at.
Yeah,
that
well,
would be delightful to include.
I've still got it, but I don't know exactly.
Just so that we know who the revenue agents are now, right?
Yeah, well, I don't. Yeah, and I didn't never know the one, but I can pick out everybody else in the picture except, and Frank Bruin, the sheriff. He was a great, big, good-looking, tall, strong man. He had the hammer.
How do you spell Bruin?
Bruin, just like the bear.
Right.
Let me get one before. The jail was down where the ready room is now.
Yes,
And where did your grandparents have their living area?
All in the very west portion of the basement. That whole thing was there. There were two or three bedrooms down there and a great big living room and a dining room and the kitchen and a bathroom. And
was it warm there in the winter?
Well, it was all steam heat, you know, and you had to, in a hand-fired furnace, and Granddad had fired that damn thing, too, and I used to help pitch coal in that and punch the flues. There were the flues in the big coal boiler had to be punched every, maybe 3 or 4 days to get the carbon out of them from the coal so that when the heat came through it, it'd heat the steam up, and the more carbon there was in the flues, the more coal it took to get steam up, because you'd have to get 15 pounds or 20 pounds of steam to send it clear up to the courtroom, and if the courtroom wasn't warm, why, the judge was raising hell because it was cold or something like that.
Still that way.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
Do you recall any other people with nicknames?
Well, let's see.
That's just what I was going to say. Yeah, Fred Pierce said that everybody had a nickname back then. Tony the Weasel.
Yeah, Tony the Weasel was one of the good ones. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll have to think about that a little bit right off the bat.
If any of them come to you, jot them down. There was,
okay.
What's his name lives over here?
Fred Pierce.
That we talked to real early on, he and his wife.
Oh, Frank Lachine.
Yeah, Frank. Frank started to give me a bunch of nicknames.
He could remember a bunch of bad.
After we had finished. It was better remembered to ask him because these were most characters that worked in the mine,
right.
Not the mine, the tunnel.
And then hung out in the Jerome bar. There was a bunch that Fred, because Fred worked in the Jerome, you know, doing
Well, one of the ones that I remember from the tunnel up there that was an absolute heller was Sully. And he was a Sullivan, but he wasn't one of the Sullivans that part of our family was related to over there. There were. But he was a character. He was in jail a lot for just overnight from coming down from the tunnel. Because most every Saturday night in the summertime, there was a dance down in the Armory Hall that all the tunnel stiffs would come down.
Tunnel skiffs?
Stiffs, we call them. Stiffs. Yeah, we call them all stiffs from... God, they were hard-working, strong men. And I guess that running those machines all the time probably drove them batty, and it's a good thing maybe they had Saturday night to come down and get swacked Saturday afternoon.
They'd have a little too much fun and get thrown in jail.
Yeah, usually. If they were real obnoxious and stuff like that, like jumping up and pulling the light cords out of the ceiling or something like that.
We thought we were weird, huh?
Yeah, we do. I think we are.
What year were you born?
I was born in 20.
1920?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I contracted...
You're going to have to speak up more because it's not registering much, so just speak louder.
I think I contracted rheumatic fever when I was 21 years old, and... That put me down for about 3.5 to 4 years.
Wow. Did you almost die?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't, but I wasn't in... I wasn't very good at the beginning of that siege, and it took a long time to get... Because the methods that they used to treat it were so much different than, 50 years ago.
What did they do back then?
Oh, hell, I don't know. Among other things, digitalis, if your heart was, not working the way that it should, and because the rheumatic fever does something to the valves in your heart. So after got over that and thought so I could get around, I went in and the courthouse as a deputy county treasurer, and I worked in that office for Robert Kelly, who had been county treasurer for almost 20 years before, and later for Marjorie Jenkinson, who is still alive and is a good old family friend. I was her deputy for a couple of years, and then in about 1948, they needed someone down because Mr. Pepke had started buying property right about that time, and they needed somebody down in the assessor's office because the assessor at that time he was all by himself and he just was overburdened with work, and so they asked me if I would go down and help him, and golly, I was only down there for about 6 months, and then Bert Kling, K-L-I-N-G, was the assessor, and he died, and so the commissioners put me right in the office right immediately, so that was my connection from that point up until February of this year that all of those intervening years I was doing something one way or the other in the office, either as county assessor or deputy assessor.
What were the funniest stories you remember from the courthouse? I imagine there must have been some shenanigans going on there.
Yes, there were. I kept away from most of the shenanigans most of the time because all later on in that time, my father was probation officer and also veteran service officer. He served as veteran service officer for about 45 years. So I had to, keep a pretty straight face and then I was all some of those years back in that time. Usually in those days the county, someone from the county assessor's office was a deputy sheriff, because when they had to go out and in those days you had to assess sheep and cattle, and you'd have to go in and count them. And so I was a deputy sheriff for, I guess, 26 years or 27 years. But after Dick Keenest got into office, that sort of, we decided that wasn't too good of an idea anymore. So, because things were a little more complicated. But so, stories. Well, we've had, I'm sure, I haven't thought about crazy things that that happened in the courthouse for a long time, but God, I don't know, almost every day, I'm sure there was something, because back a long time ago, people would be able, up until maybe 20 years ago, why, if you had a good dog, you could bring your dog to work with you. I wouldn't say you could, but you did. So I used to bring my dog. I had a big, beautiful collie, and I used to bring my dog to work. And whenever Jiggs would want to go out, he wouldn't bother going through the door. He'd go over and stand by the window, and I'd open the window, and Jiggs would jump down that about, 8 or 9 or 10 feet down to the, the garden and down there. And so people used to come by on that when the office was over on the other side and wait for Jiggs to come out so they could take a picture of him going out the window.
Why not?
And I said, Jesus. Well, not too many people know that, because that was an interesting thing. And,
About when Bundy jumped out of the window?
That was good.
Nobody got a picture of that.
Nobody, but he came right down by the side of my window over there. I thought, gee, that
did you
see
him?
No, I never saw it. But
you thought it was Jiggs.
No, Jiggs was dead then by the time that Bundy got out. But right away, somebody from the sheriff's office come out and says that Bundy had jumped out the window. And I said, well, what in the hell? So I looked out, and I could see the pieces of the pine tree that he'd hit coming down. He kind of scraped some of the branches down and things. So then they started looking for him. But I thought, oh, my God. Because usually I was always turned around looking in. I wasn't looking outside. But I just saw him just as sure as the devil.
So you were in your office?
Yeah, I was sitting right there. I wasn't 6, probably 7 feet away from him when he came down from the upper level there, because he jumped right out.
We could do a chapter on things coming out of courthouse windows.
Yeah, courthouse windows for
Jiggs,
sure.
Jiggs, Bundy.
Yeah, oh God, and I remember we had people who will remain nameless that this even threw furniture through a closed window in the back of the courthouse that... I couldn't tell you who they were because they're still alive.
Why did they do that?
Mad, because they were mad.
Mad at the county, or
mad at everything.
Mad at everything.
County, in the county, and threw the damn things right back out and lit out in the alley. Yeah. But anyway, we better not go into that. But, oh, there's most everybody meant well, because when I was growing up, nobody had a darn thing, you know. Everybody was just kind of... when I started to work at the courthouse, I only... my pay was only like 25 cents an hour. And I had to work, too. I had to be able to type, and I had to be able to make good numbers, because we done the tax rolls in those days are all longhand. There's nothing typewritten, you know. And you had to prepare tax schedules in a big, wide carriage typewriter. And so... And then finally they raised the salary to 50 cents an hour. And that was...
When was that? Do you remember when they went?
I don't know when. I think I started getting 50 cents an hour maybe towards the... about the time I went down into the assessor's office, which would have been in 48 or 49. Yeah, I think it was...
Do you remember the precise year you went... You said it was 3 or 4 years after, so after you contracted hemorrhagic fever. It was.
I went in
the county treasurer's office first.
About 40. Must have been in the fall of 1946.
Okay.
Because I don't know. I remember Mr. Papke. The first time I ever saw Walter Papke was with Friedel Pfeiffer. They came in, and Friedel, you know, had just. Well, he'd. He'd been in the armory and had just been discharged, I believe. And I think I've got the dates right.
Yeah.
And I remember they came in the office and they were talking to the then treasurer, and they were going over the things, and they just started to build the number one lift, I think. And I think that's the right year, 40. I hope it's 46. Well,
it
I believe
is.
It was.
It is.
Okay. Well, and then when I was... youngster, a lot of the good things I got into was because I was, my both uncles were musicians, and they had played in dance orchestras, and they had orchestra and dance orchestra, and so I learned to play the clarinet when I was pretty young, and so I started playing in the Elks band, and the Elks band was the one thing that was really going good back when things, you know, everybody thought, well, things are tough. And the Elks Band gave periodic concerts. They gave a concert during July and August every Thursday night in the bandstand. And, of course, that entailed a lot of rehearsal and things like that. But I played at the when they holed through the tunnel up at Grizzly or up at Lincoln Gulch. I was not very big. I must have only been around 16 years old or thereabouts, but I played in the band when we went up there, and it was in the winter, in the dead of winter.
Oh,
God,
geez.
It must have been
fun.
January or February. Oh, God, it was awful. And we went up there, and I remember we played the Star Spangled Banner and oh, Lord, I don't know what other things. We went up everything was frozen so hard, you know, that, and they traveled the road a lot every day, and they had clay tracks, and they could brush the snow off and everything. So we went probably some of the older people in the band had cars, like an old Buick touring car, and I think there was a Graham Page, but I got a ride. Whatever car my two uncles went in, I got to go. So we went up there and we done that. And then I played when they dedicated the Highland Bavarian Lodge up Castle Creek, where Coffee's place is up there. Used to be, I don't know what the hell, who owns it now, you know, that the place right...
Heatherbed?
No, it's right. It's on Castle. It's right there on the bank of overlooking Conundrum Creek, and where that beautiful place is, where the couple of little ponds is right above the Highland Mine there, you know, there... Well, anyway, that was a Highland Bavarian thing,
and that was
Tom Fisk, or I mean Billy Fisk and Tom Flynn, and they were going to build the tramway to the top of Mount Hayden back in those days. And then Billy Fisk was killed in the war. He was the first American pilot killed over in Germany. Well, anyway, well, they dedicated that, and I went up there, and we played on that. And then when they dedicated the sun deck, or finished number two lift, and the sun deck was done, I was still playing in the band then, and we played, and we went up and played that. We'd done the Star Spangled Banner and two or three Sousa marches and a few things like that, so... I got to blow around on a lot of those, but I was thinking I couldn't blow very much now. I've got a hell of a fever blister, and I know that always used to be the curse of the clarinet players. Jesus!
Did your uncles teach you to play?
Oh God, yes. They were there. Well, my uncles they played everything though. They were good musicians, and they had the orchestra. They had the Romer Rhythm Kings, and they played all over. Rhythm King. Romer, or whatever, Romer, like a Romer. Yeah. Rhythm Kings, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've got a picture of that orchestra someplace, too. I'd say the Romers were going good about 1935, 36, 37, 38. 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, those years about like that, the Depression years when they'd only get like maybe, $25 for playing for a dance like on Saturday night for... five of them, sometimes six of them. And boy, it was hard going to spend all the time practicing and everything. Like they'd have to go someplace where there was a piano, you know, because there was always a good piano player and probably two saxophones, a trumpet, trombone, and they'd interchange instruments and maybe even a violin player once in a while too.
Now, did Freddie Pierce play in this too?
Fred never played in the Romer Rhythm Kings because
in the Elks Club one?
No.
No.
No, I'm the only one. Louis Sapansis and I are the only ones left in Aspen that played in the Elks band.
The Elks band?
Yeah.
When did they disband the Elks band?
Well, it had to be about the time I got. Well, I don't know. I tried to play after I got sick, and I couldn't because. So it must have been about 42 or 3, something like that, that the Elks band went out.
The dances were really well attended.
Dances were well attended, and it was damn good music, too, because, you know, they'd play, it wasn't any of this play one or two things and then get down and go around and smoke and stuff like that. They'd play maybe 15 or 16 different things, foxtrot and a waltz and whatever and whatever and whatever. And then they'd have intermission. And then you'd go and you'd know that you were going to be for 15 minutes and the guys, they could go outside and get a drink of whatever.
Cannibals.
Or something where they had some bootleg...
Tony the Weasel.
Tony the Weasel and Hannibal Brown.
Yeah, or have some of the home brew from somebody that was brewing good stuff.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you something about the courthouse, since you're mm-hmm. probably the biggest expert on the courthouse. Why does the woman on top of the courthouse have no blindfold? What's the story behind that?
The most honest thing that I can get, because my great uncle Emery, he worked on the courthouse. He and Mr. Quayle, I believe it was, where he plastered most of the inside of that damn the courthouse. Any place there's any plaster going, why? It was an Emery Connor thing. I won't say he plastered the whole thing, but he was a plasterer by trade. And on one of the, I've heard, I think, I don't know whether Dad or somebody else asked him once, and he said he thought that it was perhaps the particular foundry where that thing was cast or something like that, that maybe, you know, that they that just happened to be maybe the way the architect designed it. And I don't know that there's any special story. I've heard, you know, a lot of people have concocted things, but the most honest thing that I could say was that particular casting was done by someone that said, well, that's the way that we visualize justice.
Is anybody crawled up there and put a blindfold on her?
Oh, sure, lots of times.
When did that happen? I've always wanted to do that.
Many times,
oh, really?
Yes.
When was it? Did anybody get caught?
No, because it usually was somebody in the courthouse probably helping them out. Yeah, that's
Hey,
the truth.
Put yours up there. That will show up.
That's the truth. The judges.
You never can tell. We had a few that wouldn't mind doing it, and some of the justices of the peace, and too that we used to have that system here, you know, until 25 years ago or so. But I've saw a lot of red ones and blue ones and.
When was the last time? It wasn't too terribly long ago, was it, that somebody did that?
Yeah, within the last 2 or 3 years.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, they did. They had a Bronco T-shirt on.
Right. Somebody did the Bronco T-shirt. That was definitely an inside job.
Why didn't you put the pig up there? Pig up there with her.
Yeah, there's a lot of things put up there in the thing, but it usually someone in the inside has, you know, had to acquiesce and say, well, we'll do that, because there wasn't any no way anybody could get up there and do that without somebody fronting for them or distracting.
They have to get from the inside.
Oh, sure.
Well, what were some of the funny stories that you heard of why she didn't have a bandana on with the concoctions? Do you remember any of those?
It was just for Halloween or some of those when there would be maybe celebration here where there's going to be a lot of people in town and they wanted it to look a little bit different. I think, yeah.
What about when they found marijuana growing up at the courthouse? Do you remember that one?
Yeah, but that wasn't I don't think that was as serious as a lot of people have made it out to be.
Oh, really? Because,
no, I don't think so.
I remember seeing those plants there.
I remember once when some of the drug enforcement agencies would find, hell, I think they found a marijuana plant growing, I'm not sure, maybe even down next to City Hall, but it had to be something they know somebody had dropped, or a seed fell or something like that.
Or they did it to embarrass.
Yeah, and hell, that don't grow very good up here, I understand, anyway, unless you got special conditions. So.
Did anyone ever come into the courthouse with a gun and threaten to kill anyone in the county that you...
No, but there was always a lot of I'll knock your goddamn head off and a few things like that, you know. Yeah, but I never did see any... thank God I never saw any guns in my time. And I guess I'd have run across them if there'd have been anybody have anything around, but it was always... When I began to work in the courthouse, the sheriff's office was upstairs. They had a special office upstairs, so there was always somebody, you know, going up and down the steps or something like that. So that was pretty evident, because in order to come from the outside, you had to go and pass through the hall and go up the stairs. And then finally, when they moved the office downstairs, then you didn't maybe see as much of them. But they were always pretty darn close if you needed anyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, traditionally, assessors are pretty disliked when it comes
to
reassessing.
That's
were you
it.
Ever threatened?
We
ever threatened by anyone because of a change in the assessment or the tax?
No. I've had several people... I think I could be very honest and say that all the years I was lucky enough to be diplomatic enough to avoid those kind of things. You know, I've heard some threats about, well, don't send someone that would be working for me out because I'll run him off or I'll... But yes, there have been, for some of the people that worked in the office, there were threats that they'd put their dog on him or something and things like that. But I guess no one ever told me that there were a few people invited me outside, and when I got ready to go out with them and we got out and started down the steps, they changed their mind. So at least I didn't get my teeth knocked out by anybody, but I went down out with them anyway a couple of times. That's a lot of this and a lot of the animosity that may be shown towards county assessors is entirely misunderstanding between the taxpayer, the person that owns the property, and the person that's doing the work. Because if you know what the hell you're doing and you've got a reason for doing it, there shouldn't be. Sure, you can have violent disagreements or wide disagreements, but you don't have to get it in this business where, oh, I don't know. Oh, I've had people tell me, and one woman told me that when she was going to pull all my hair out, and I said, God, don't get going too bad on me, because I said, I don't have a hell of a lot to spare. That was quite a while ago, but she was so mad. And then in about 2 months, she apologized. Yes. And I said, you didn't need to do that. I didn't think you meant it. And I thought, God, I didn't. I've had a couple of people tell me they were going to. One woman told me once she was going to smack me, and I said, "Well, you know, there isn't any need for that." And then, in a couple of months, she told me she was taking some kind of medicine that made her crazy. And
Hooch, probably.
Well, I don't know, but she said she was having a nervous breakdown, and they were trying some kind of new stuff, and so she said she apologized, and so, but you know, there's always something that but now I don't know. I wouldn't want to say that what's been going on lately. I'm sure there's been some bad exhibits of bad manners on both sides in the office now this year, but oh dear.
Can you kind of I'm trying to think of the vast difference between the property and the value of it when you started and the value of property here today.
Well,
is there any way to put it into a perspective?
Well, I don't know, Gaylor, but I would say if you wanted to, I believe the, of course, you know, using figures to make those comparisons, you don't know exactly what you're doing, because the percentages in order to arrive at assessed valuation has changed. In my, you know, there's been so many definitions of what value is. You know, there's cash value, loan value, market value, and now the damn statutes say actual value, and then the percentages to arrive at the assessed value. But when I went in the office the first time, the assessed valuation, I believe, of the county was $1 million, we'll just say $800,000. Well, back then, that involved an awful lot of things, because there were probably, in those days, you had to value the sheep. So we'll say there was 20,000 sheep in that thing. There might have been 4,000 cows. And when you had to get all of those straightened out, you know, like maybe Wagner's would have 180 cows, and you'd go up to Nadel's and maybe he'd have 46, and you'd go and jumping around and everything. Like, so it was a terrible process of accumulating all that stuff and then valuing the lots around town. Some of the lots around town back in those days, $25, $50, $80, per lot, depending upon where they were. And so I watched the progression of those things go through that stage into the, like, the $500 level and into the $1,000 level and into the $10,000, the $20,000, the $30,000, the $40,000, the $50,000, the $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000. And so, but then the thing that threw it off, perhaps 10 years ago, then they quit assessing cattle and sheep.
Yeah.
farmers don't have to pay on livestock anymore. You don't have to pay on farm equipment anymore. And that used to be one hell of a job because you had to go and inventory the whole damn thing, all the mowers and the tractors and the hay rakes and whether you had a side delivery rake or a front delivery rake and go through. Oh, God, it was awful. And that's what, you know, a lot of people think that, well, things are complicated now. Jesus, they were awful complicated before because you'd done them all manually and you had to go out and then you'd go to some place and the guy couldn't speak good English, you know, or they were giving you that they couldn't say so.
Yeah.
You'd say, well, you know, and tell him what you do. And then he wouldn't tell you, well, you could say, well, hell, I'm looking out there and it looks like there's damn near 60 cows out there in that field. Are those yours? And then maybe get a nod out of the thing, you belong to them. And then you'd have to go and count them. And we had counters, and we'd go, and you'd look, and you'd have to separate them and say, I've got five. And
counting?
Yeah, and that way, and you know, it was serious business because you had to put the things down right, and then you had to report them to the state, you know, and the state would then, while they wouldn't check them, they would know, and in the case of sheep, there was a tax on sheep called a predatory animal tax because the state imposed that tax to pay for the trappers, to pay for the coyote trappers. And so when they dropped that, the agricultural assessment, that helped an awful lot, and it helped the farmers too. But the progression is, as I mentioned, I think I started out when the assessed valuation was around $1,600,000 or thereabouts, and it's over, the assessed valuation is $500 million now. And that means that $500 million means that only represents a percentage of the actual value of the property, which is probably... residential property is a little over 14% of the actual value, and commercial property is 29%. So just, and there's, yeah, so you just, to be safe, there's a lot more residential than there is commercial. So say you multiply that 500,000 times 5 and you get $2.5 billion. And so.
Did you ever have anyone, did you ever catch anyone hiding any cows or sheep?
Oh, yes. Yes.
How'd you find them?
Well, because I'd always ask, because they said, well, there's no use of you being honest if so-and-so is coming in here from Kansas